This episode of the Renegade HBG podcast is sponsored by the Kickstarter campaign for the Redline Tactical Card Combat Game. Developed by Battletech fans as an homage to that long-dormant CCG, Redline is an expandable card game featuring simultaneous combat and mission-based objectives. Deploy your army, then secure and hold territory to win. The Kickstarter is live now through September 4th. Visit Kickstarter now and search Redline to find out more and to support this exciting new entry into the wargaming field. Let's dive in. So everyone, welcome to this awesome episode of the Renegade HBG podcast. My guests today are Terry Bohr and Peter Sundholm, the first and second place at the original 1997 World Championships for the Battletech trading card game. And Terry, who came back the following year to kind of avenge that loss to Peter at the final table to win his own championship in 1998. But we're going to be kind of diving a little bit in, kind of following this theme. The channel's been exploring this old classic game. And we're going to be talking a little bit about the old days and kind of perspective about the game from when it originally launched and kind of that top competitive level. So without me talking too much and just kind of diving in, thanks, Peter and Terry, for joining us for what is actually the second time. You know, big secret that the first recording got completely deleted due to technical error. So these gentlemen have been very kind to sit down with me and mostly pretend to have this awesome conversation all over again. For you guys, but I'm sure we'll cover some new stuff we didn't cover the first time as well. But yeah, thanks guys, double for kind of coming in and having this conversation for take number two here. So to kind of kick off, my initial question, I want to kind of pick your brains just in terms of, I certainly want to hear what the early days of the TCG were like, but I'm curious kind of what first brought you into the game. Were you guys Battletech fans kind of leading up to the release of the trading card game? Did you have any exposure to it either through the tabletop or the video games? Or were you kind of like others where, kind of caught up in that CCG boom of that mid-90s and kind of found the game through that? Start with you, Peter.
So I'm obviously, I live just an hour down from WotC land where the Magic started with the Magic trading card game. So I certainly played Magic, and Magic was the gateway drug for me to get into it. However, the reason I specifically started playing Battletech was because since back in 1990, my local group, the Royal Olympic Guards, we've been playing Battletech, the actual mini game. As a matter of fact, in the mid 90s, I was actually raided by MechForce North America, which was the competitive board game rating system. I was in the top 10 in the Americas. And so we played the board game every Sunday with the group religiously. So it was just a natural jump for me once the card game came out to actually start playing the card game, of course.
Excellent. Terry, had you played it before, or was that trading card game your first exposure?
I had played Battletech as a kid and Car Wars, the Peter Jackson game, which is to me a lot like Battletech. You have cars instead of mechs, but it's the same idea. So I played that. I had played a little bit of some of the online Battletech occasional game of some sort of miniature. I came in, though, through Magic, similar to Peter. I played Magic a lot, and I think my friend Yik, Xiaokao, who's a prof now in Canada, he kind of introduced me to the game. That's what I remember. And I really liked it. I thought the game had a cool theme and good mechanics, was a lot of fun to play. It was, in many ways, I thought, a better game than Battletech. The drawing the two cards meant that I feel like in Magic, you just lose one every four or five games through a bad draw. And Battletech much more rarely had bad draws. So I kind of, enjoyed the game. We were already going to the 1997 Gen Con. So we figured, why don't we go and play in the World Championship. I can't remember if I had to qualify or not. I think I do remember qualifying.
Not in the first one.
Okay.
The second one we had to qualify, but not the first one.
Okay. So the second one I remember, I think I qualified a couple places, but in 97, I think I just showed up and played.
Awesome. And what was that qualification like? Because I know even in these days for a lot of games, it's just kind of, certainly for the smaller ones, it's just whoever can make it goes. But, and even the qualification's kind of weird. What was, and for those listening, I mean, some people are listening, they weren't even born back then. So they don't understand that the internet and the kind of vast organizational network wasn't the same back in, 97 that it is now. So, how did that local competitive scene work? How do you guys kind of get tied into it, and what was that qualification process?
I think I recall doing a qualifier in Montreal. My family's from Montreal, and I think we were there on a visit, and it coincided, and I played at some local shop. And I remember there being quite a few people there. This is a long time ago now. And yeah, it was fun to play and see what something was like. I may also have played a qualifier, like a tournament in Toronto. My memory is a bit fuzzy, but I remember, yeah, qualifying through there. And I'm pretty sure I might have had a qualification from being second place the year before. So I think I kind of played more like a warm-up just to see what it was like, and actually quite enjoyed the Battletech tournaments.
What was kind of that initial meta like for the game, and kind of what was kind of popular kind of on the local scene for you guys, you know, in terms of decks and strategies, and kind of how did that evolve through that first year as you kind of led into that big championship?
Peter, do you want to answer?
Yeah. So, I mean, we pretty much have local meta games. Like there was Scry Magazine and a few different, entities that we, like, there was not really any internet that you could, you know, scry and just look up decks per se. Like there was the Magic Dojo and a few things in the early days that had started for Magic, but certainly not for Battletech. I remember later on, I think it was year two or year three, they actually did list a few of the World Championship decks, but certainly there was no Battletech section for us to look up. So it was more, we had our local meta games, and then it was like you heard through the rumor mill that, hey, there's like, for example, the Zandhurst deck was one that certainly blew up really fast because it was such an explosive deck that nobody could keep that under wraps. And so there were like some of those decks, just through the grapevine, you heard through the qualifier tournaments that there was like this deck. And so we had to build our own versions of it, but like there were our own versions. We didn't have like card for card what the deck looked like.
Right. So there's still a lot of leeway for creativity there in that.
Certainly, yes.
Yeah. Terry, did you have a similar experience, or were you kind of, you know, dead set on kind of the same strategy that you ended up bringing to Worlds that first year?
I was completely blind in the first year. We showed up. My deck was not very good in the first Worlds. I think I was a pretty good player because I have had lots and lots of game experience, and I tend to be good at the more complex games. But yeah, my deck wasn't great, and we just sort of came in and played, and that's where we came. The second year was different. We didn't really look at any meta. We built all the decks ourselves. We knew what the... I probably built basically the top three or four decks that I saw out there. We knew them, and we knew that our deck could beat all of them. There was only the pilot deck that maybe we were a little afraid of, and we tried to organize against that a little bit, but there they needed to get a good draw. And we had no outside resources whatsoever to that helped us, which is different than how Magic has evolved around that time. Magic at that time was just starting to be people who could pull decks off the internet and play them. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, even for Magic, when I was playing in the Pro Tour, we just built all our own decks. And if you look at our results, like in some of like Pro Tour Chicago, I think this would be 1997 maybe, where the twin deck I was playing won the tournament, a guy named Paul McCabe, who was a friend of mine. I finished, maybe I was top 32 or something. I took a bad turn somewhere in that tournament, but there was all created. It wasn't really, we didn't get it off of anything. It was only later that people started to show up with these pre-made decks that were really excellent. So I think this was kind of pre-internet meta. And I thought that was good. That was a kind of a pure way to play the game and the way I liked it.
Yeah, and that was kind of my next question was just, you guys have been playing, from before the internet to kind of once it evolved, do you think that access to that information has elevated the game in terms of just the competitive level and what it kind of, almost kind of an arms escalation, as it were, in terms of the difficulty of the decks? Or do you think it's kind of taken away too much in terms of that individual creativity, with deck building and kind of the onus on the player to kind of build from scratch and come up with their own ideas?
I think it's significantly worse to know exactly what to do. I think that takes away one of what I think was one of the most fun parts of Magic and a huge element of skill. So like, for example, in Magic, there was like this meta tournament once a year where the top 16 players play in. I played in that once. And one of the guys, I think the guy who actually won, although I'd have to go look this up exactly, he had people prep decks for him. So they would say, here's your deck for this special format. Here's your deck for this special format. And I thought that kind of thing sort of ruined what was happening. There were too many people who could just pick up a deck, practice with it, buy it, and make it work. And it cut down the skill level. It increased the luck. And I think it kind of made the game a little bit less fun to see like 5, 6, 7 identical decks all over the place, all tuned and all just taken off from the week before. So I didn't personally enjoy that.
All right. Peter, did you have, you know, similar perspective?
So, no, I actually have a slightly different perspective. First of all, I think meta decking is inevitable. And I think it's inevitable because people want to, if you want to compete, you need to, you know, have the best decks, I guess. And so you're clearly going to copy whatever the best deck is. So I actually think the onus is on the creators of the card games, whatever they are, to make sure that they create a diverse card game and a diverse metagame. I think that's extremely important. Like this last cycle of Magic that we just went through, that went through a very, very restrictive metagame. And so they had to start banning cards. And so I think they failed on creating a very diverse metagame. Whereas if you look at Legends of Runeterra, created by Riot Games, Electronic Ways, it has probably like six different games that are in the, you know, in the top tier, or decks, that is. So they have a very healthy metagame. And so I think it's based on the card game itself, and the onus is on them. I actually think it's good, and I think it's good, and the reason why is that there's always going to be creative minds. Terry's crew certainly was one of them in the Battletech era, I think. And they're always going to come up with answers, whether there's a posted deck or not.
And what do you think, you know, in terms of kind of the responsibility of from the designer side and kind of the work that they need to do, like what are the elements that they need to be considering in order to ensure that happens? Is that simply a matter of really kind of designing the game out a couple of years into the future and making sure they're kind of staying ahead? Or is it just kind of a more consistency in terms of the elements and not introducing too much? You know, kind of what kind of, you know, hits that sweet spot in terms of design to kind of avoid those pitfalls?
See, I think there's two tiers to that. One of them is a level of arrogance that the actual creators have, that they think that they know better than the actual community. Mm-hmm. And we had in 98, we discussed it in the first recording, but in 98, we had a community tournament where up here in WotC land, mm-hmm. the actual creators threw the gauntlet down, because up here at the time, we had the top five of the top 10 rated players in the world. So we had a murderer's row of competitive players up here in the community, for the Battletech community. And so because of that, the creators threw down the gauntlet and said, we're going to have an event where we play the players in an exclusive event. And so then they invited the top 32 players from around here to come play them up at the WotC Center. And they said, there will be no players in the top four. There will only be, creators. They were all boasting how they had all these hidden touchstone decks that we hadn't figured out. And of course, like we just discussed at the time, there were no posted decks and stuff. Yeah. And sure enough, had it not been for a shady pairing in the last round, because the pairings were supposed to be player versus creator, where they, in the final round, paired two creators against each other and managed to sneak one creator into the top four, it would have in fact been all players and no creators. But the final top four was three players and one creator, and we ousted him in the semifinals. So the players was myself versus my best friend Dave Hymas in the finals. So no, there were no creators in the finals. Passion beats job any day is what I think it proves to me.
Yeah, and just raw numbers too. I mean, the community is, exponential would be a disservice to say how big the community is compared to the people that are designing it. So,
but yet they felt that way though. Like they truly felt that they had like us all beat, that we had no understanding of how good their decks were. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that a sense of humility has crept into kind of modern game designers? Certainly Magic is still going, strong in terms of community. Do you think they've kind of learned the lessons of the past or from other games? Or do you think that's still kind of a characteristic that you see in the people that are making the cards that you get to play?
So the fact that they still keep on trying to create zero cost cards, which should never, ever, ever be created in a card game. No, I don't.
Okay.
I mean, literally, they have never created a zero cost card that does not break the game in some way, shape, or fashion, and they still keep trying to do it.
Interesting.
Like they just have not learned their lesson. They're like, this time we're going to figure it out, and then they break the game again. It's like, no, you can't do it. Stop doing it.
Well, that's good. That's good to know, because I had thanks to Michael Todd, who's a prolific kind of fan fiction producer and who I'd had a podcast on recently. He and his friends had come up with a template, and he passed it on to me. So I've been having a blast, kind of making my own TCG BattleTech kind of custom cards and fan cards. And one of them was like a Wasp, which was a zero cost. So maybe I need to revisit that. You know,
it'll break the game.
Oh no,
it'll break the game.
And I know somebody had mentioned that original, that Sentinel, that zero cost, zero buyout Sentinel that kind of emerged, and people were trying to put 60 of those in a deck before that six card cap does. You know, did you guys encounter anything crazy like that? You know, or any kind of weird dynamics that popped onto the scene before kind of the limitations were placed on cards like that?
I mean, I played a lot of zero cost cards. This is from my world championship. Sorry, I mean, I'm like filled with that. There's the Cyrano, right? Was a zero cost, and if we get the right draw, we kill you in like four turns. It's incredibly fast, and we put in so many of those different cards, and that made a huge difference. So I can see that being problematic.
Yes,
zero cost, yeah.
So what's the solution to that? Cards that like it's hard to justify one, and so they push them to two. Like what's the fix for that? What can people are these as kind of fan designers like myself here making my own cards? What can I do to make sure I'm not, you know, creating a game breaking card with a zero cost?
Just don't make a zero cost card. Okay.
So one minimum, no buyouts.
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Don't try to cheat the system. I mean, that's the thing, is they're trying to cheat the system, right? Mm. That's the whole point.
Yeah, yeah. Gotcha. Now, I mean, you guys both have vast experience in terms of Magic the Gathering, as we've been talking about here, and have both played at a very high level for that. I'm curious about your perspective in terms of the comparison between the two games and kind of, you know, how BattleTech, the trading card game, compared to Magic the Gathering. You know, certainly they're both Richard Garfield games and BattleTech came later. So, you know, we're assuming that he had a lot more experience, you know, when he was designing BattleTech. I know a lot of people kind of love the fact that in BattleTech, everything on the board is fair game. But I'm curious from you guys, from having been at the very top of BattleTech and have been very close to the top of Magic the Gathering, kind of what your you know, perceptions are into the relative you know, strengths and weaknesses between both the games, and what really draws you to one game over the other.
Terry, go ahead.
So, I mean, I've played a lot of card games and a lot of different games, and I've played multiple games at the very top level, not just BattleTech and Magic. I think that Magic was able to strike kind of, in some sense, the perfect balance. They were able to have a game that was good enough for beginner players to have some chance and to enjoy it. It had enough art and theme. It had enough variety in the cards. The land system, you know, is very luck-based. So many games, even at the professional levels, come down to which cards you draw, how much land you get, and that has its pluses and minuses. You know, you could have a good enough deck without paying a ton of money, but if you paid a lot more, yes, you could have some extra pluses there. And that, I think all of the game was pretty fun to play. All of those things came together to build the biggest game. They kind of, in some sense, got everything right enough. Okay. BattleTech, I think was, in many ways, I preferred BattleTech to Magic. Like, I really enjoyed BattleTech as a card game, and the mechanics were really tight. It was very complex, but I don't think it was necessarily a great game for beginners, because if I were to play a beginner, I would win 99 times out of 100. You know, I played a tournament where I drew only two resources the whole game, and I was still able to win by picking off people's cards, just barely hanging on, desperately hoping to draw a third resource in a card where I had tons of resources in my deck and I'm drawing two cards a turn. And it just never happened. I was still able to kind of pull out that game. And it kind of speaks to the change of luck that is in those games, right? In the way that chess, just great game in many ways, but it's just not really very fun for a beginner. And once you get past a certain skill, you always win or you always lose against certain opponents, right? It's hard to find that little range. So I think that's what Magic really, really did right. Another thing I thought BattleTech did right was the people by and large were friendly. Like, you might play the game and you do like a little cheer before the round started and so on. It wasn't as much business as the Magic Pro Tour was. Back then, it was still pretty significant money, and we were starting to see an emergence of like professional players. I'll put professional in quotes. They were, you know, a lot of them were living in their parents' basement and just not going to school and doing nothing but play Magic. But maybe professional is a little generous, but you get what I'm saying. Like, they were really hardcore into the game and they played a lot and so on. So that started to get serious really, really fast right in the first year of the Pro Tour. And I think BattleTech never really was was like that. And I think that was a strength of the game. But in the end, I don't know that Battletech really had enough replayability, that every set was different enough that there was a reason to go back in and pick up those cards and do something new. They just didn't quite have the player base, and I don't know that the cards quite had that mechanic. They would have had to make some pretty significant changes to future sets to make it really interesting and keep people coming back to play.
Yeah. Peter, did you have a similar insight?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with Terry that I think it would have fallen to its own success in the end as far as like consistency. What people complain about Magic the most is mana screw, right? And it's actually, I believe, the reason for why Magic is still so successful 30 years into the game is because of mana screw. It's actually the one ingenious part that Richard accidentally built into the game. And I say accidentally because I don't think he actually wanted to build something so infuriating into the game.
Yeah.
But that's the reason for why, you know, Bobby, 5 years old, can sit across from the world champion and actually beat him in a game. That will never happen in Battletech. Never. What Terry just described, where you can sit with two resources and actually beat somebody that is less skilled than you in Battletech, is because when you have two resources and two choices every turn, those choices, they will accumulate over the length of a game. And those, when you keep on making bad choices, and a good player, experienced player, will keep on making the correct or the most optimal choices every turn, those optimal choices will escalate your bad choices over the length of a game, which means that there will come a middle part of the game where suddenly your bad choices will catch up to you and the game will just end for you. Gotcha. And that doesn't exist in Magic to the same extent, because there's always that luck part of the chance that Battletech has almost eliminated. It's not quite there because there's still some, you know, elements of luck in Battletech as well. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole lot less. That was actually part of what drew me into it, because I, like Terry, am a very experienced gamer. I have played a myriad of different games at a very high level. I guess we're both alpha competitors, I guess.
Yeah.
And the fact is that that's why Battletech was so successful early on, and why it drew players like myself and Terry, I believe, into the game, but also why the length of its success, I don't think, like, it was written in stone, even though I believe it ultimately failed because of, you know, FASA and the licensing and stuff.
Right.
I actually think that the length of the game would have probably been just a few years longer anyways, just because of the game engine itself, because I don't think, like, we saw it in just the tournament sizes, because, like, there were less and less people coming to our tournaments. And now, part of that up here in WotC Land, like I said, was that you'd come here and we'd have 5 of the top 10 players in the world coming to our tournaments. Like, facing that murderer's row in your local tournament scene is horrible, because you'd come here and lose every round. Mm-hmm. So as a new player, you'd come here and you'd never win a game. Like, it takes a very special player. We had one of those, by the way, Jack. Shout out to you if you're out there. Mm-hmm. Like, he literally came and took his medicine every week, lost every single game, and kept coming back.
Yeah.
Like, there are very few people that'll do that, though. Like, there's not too many people that'll keep doing that.
And Terry, you had mentioned kind of just the lack of variety that was kind of introduced in each set. You know, do you guys kind of have perspective or kind of ideas? Because I know in the community now, you know, it's a dead game. People aren't tied to kind of what the original design is. They can make their own home rules. I know some of the guys have made full comprehensive sets to kind of, you know, streamline the game a little bit better, and kind of play on their own, and have shared that with the community. Are there, you know, I know it's a big ask kind of looking, you know, 20 years back, but, you know, are there ideas that you guys can kind of, you know, give to those other players to kind of keep it engaging and interesting for them at home, or even kind of thoughts that you have in terms of had the game continued of ideas for the design decision to keep it to where it was, had longevity, and that when it kind of suffered from its own success?
Sure. I've got lots of ideas. One idea is you have to rotate out sets, which is pretty much what everyone does now. Okay. So that way you can't sort of keep with the same cards in the same deck, and you don't have to have quite as much card power escalation like you have. I mean, that's one idea. The second thing is that we did talk about this in the first taping is, you know, Big Mechs really weren't very good. And, you know, you have to give them a bit of a benefit that as you pay more, you presumably should get something more, and you can have mechanics similar to like a battle cry mechanic in Hearthstone, where it does something when it comes into play, like maybe be restores 5 cards from your discard pile back to your stockpile. So you get some tempo back as you play these larger cards, and it gives you time to live longer, because normally you just don't live long enough to play a deck. Like, you finally spend 12 on this card, you bring out a slow mech, it's just useless. And then the only thing you could do with that slow mech is then guard your stockpile. Like, those mechs were just so incredibly bad and really, really, really overpriced. I went back and looked at some of those cards. So you fix that. Zvi Moskowitz did a pretty cool deck, the all resource deck that kind of fireballed you at the end. I thought that deck was pretty cool, and had definitely some good potential. So, you know, exploring some of those spell-based things were kind of, would be kind of neat. And the other part that I liked is, sealed deck and drafts, I think, is always a cool way to have replayability. And it lets you play a bunch of cards that you wouldn't otherwise play, right? I find that that's really, really fun, to play different mechs or other things like that, or have tournaments with restrictions. Like, I think Bobby Fischer in chess once said, chess is kind of like a bad game now, because you just go through these opening trees of how you play your first, 10, 12, 15 moves, whatever, right? You're not really playing chess until you get past where other players have gone before. So maybe you randomly arrange the back row of your pieces, something like that. So you can find ways to introduce different rules into it. Like, you must have 10 cards that cost 10 or more, or, you've got a random card that summons from your deck, or, there's all kinds of crazy things that could happen or could increase luck. Those are awesome. That's another idea. Like, Command Circuit is a card that I actually played in the World Championship. We hated it because it has die roll. On one and two, you just bury the card and you lose it, and that's really tough. 3, 4, 5, you get basically back that draw and the deploy. And 6, you get 3 cards and 3 deploys. So if you can cause it to live a couple turns, it's really powerful. Your expected value is quite good. But it introduces so much variation into that game. And maybe Battletech needed more of that.
Yeah.
Not less.
And you had mentioned draft, and I had gotten in. I played Star Wars Destiny last year, but I was kind of between jobs, so I wasn't going to be dropping tons of money on buying boxes, and ended up just playing draft exclusively, and had a blast with it. But I think that's definitely, Peter, you were talking about kind of your kind of diehard, kind of newbie coming in, but I feel like that draft, because also kind of adds an element, at least so that I think the experienced players are also going to certainly have a huge benefit in draft, but they're at least not, those new players aren't playing against kind of that vast amount of resource and card availability,
levels the benefit field a little bit.
Yeah. And at least you get rid of that kind of net decking aspect too, as you get back to that kind of core where people have to kind of use their creativity and bring that kind of deck building back into it, when they're doing drafts. So, that's definitely kind of a fun approach there. And I feel like, and as I've been kind of, just kind of, building these cards on my own and kind of brainstorming like what would happen if like the game was rebuilt, it seems Battletech is so custom suited to, what you've mentioned, Terry, in terms of rotating out cards. Because you have your eras, you have your 3025 era, you got your Clan Invasion era, and then you got the later era, your Jihad, your Civil War, and now they're all the way up to 100 years later with the Ilkhan era about to launch. And so that just seems such a natural thing, if the game was there and evolving, and say, all right, well, this round we're at this time era, and we're stuck into mechs there, so you don't have to worry about that power creep. Well, I did want to kind of hop in and do a little question and answer with this on and off. I definitely have a ton of questions myself, but the one guest that we were able to get to kind of hop on to ask this question in person is actually kind of signed on and waiting. So I want to kind of go ahead and kind of pull him in. And so this is Michael Cohen, who's one of the admins for the Battletech CCG Facebook group, and who has done an amazing amount to kind of revitalize and keep the community going. And so let me go ahead and bring Michael in. And I know he had a question that I was going to toss out to you guys. This is my first time kind of doing a Q&A, so hopefully things hop in all right. Michael, you hear us?
Hey!
Oh, welcome.
Nice to meet you guys.
It works. So everybody, Michael Cohen here, and Michael, I gave you a little introduction before you signed on, people know the contribution that you made to the community, and kind of make sure they're going to that Battletech CCG Facebook page to kind of engage if they're interested. But let me kind of toss that baton over to you, and you can kind of pick the brains of these guys with some of your vastly more experienced player than I am.
Sure. Awesome. So I guess it's nice to meet you guys. I've obviously read a lot about you, and a few of the folks from the old tournament scene have been back into the community since the demise of the Yahoo group, notably like Gustav and Mark, which is, they really make really great contributions. There seem to be, well, my first question, the one I posted to Travis was, it has to do with sideboarding. Obviously nobody's really run a true competitive constructed tournament since the old days. One of the main reasons for that is that, well, at least I personally believe, some people disagree, but I believe that the meta was left in something of a broken state after Crusade. And there are certain things that just work too well and never got any official changes. But one of the, as a result of this, one of the lost arts of Battletech CCG has been the art of the sideboard. How do you think about sideboarding? There's a few pieces that bug me about this. The first is that while a Magic sideboard is 15 cards, a Battletech sideboard is really only 8 cards. And that is not a lot. You have to fit a lot in. And when you do put things in there, the card count is so low that it feels like the odds of it actually making any difference, unless you dump like 4 or 5 cards from your sideboard into your deck, the odds of it making any difference are pretty minimal. So how do you think about sideboarding? How do you design a sideboard, and how does it actually, how does it work?
Terry, you want to start?
Sure. I mean, I don't think people use their sideboards that much in Magic or in other games. If you have to do a lot of sideboarding, your deck is probably not tuned well enough. There's usually a way that kind of generally handles it. But the sideboard gives you an opportunity to play 4 or 5 cards against someone that can really affect the, you know, in the meta. So we were worried about, in Battletech 98 Worlds, we were worried about Tzvi Moskowitz type deck, which is an all resource deck. And we put in a card like, you know, financial, or I had it in mind, financial collapse, right? Which basically, if I understood how this works correctly, still basically kills his deck at some point, right? He puts a bunch of counters on, and on my turn, I just build a big mech and destroy that card. So it gives me a large advantage in the game. So you have to know what cards are, you know, you might be weak against. We put in Unlikely Love Affair, which basically is an anti-pilot card. That seemed kind of reasonable. That was one of the few ways I thought that my deck could really lose, was against those really big pilots that someone can get out using a special card. So I think you just have to look at those critical weaknesses and know enough about the meta to see which is the deck I really don't want to play, and are there any cards that can counter that deck. And right. Usually, I think putting in 4 or 5 cards actually does make a significant difference.
So you might, for example, say, these are the 2 archetypes that I am most concerned about. I'm going to put 4 cards against that archetype, 4 cards against that archetype. And like, that's it. Just the 1 or 2 things.
Yeah, that's it. You know, in Magic, it was more clear. Like, there were a lot of creatureless decks. So if you have kill cards in your deck, you want to swap them out. And that's that was a good use of the sideboard. But most of the time, I think the sideboards don't make a big difference. Not in a best of 3 match.
Peter, did you have a similar experience there? I know in your sideboard for the 97, there's 2 cards. There's 6 of 1 and 2 in the other.
Correct. So. Yeah. We were ready to fog out anything that tempo wise we needed to do. So 96, we were all about the fogging stuff. So that's why the sideboard is extremely simple minded. We got a little more complicated in 98, where we actually did more what Terry did, and we actually went after multiple archetypes. In 97, and it really has more to do with the fact that the game had evolved, right? So we had a better understanding of what decks were out there, whereas in 97, we were more just, this is our deck, and this is what is bad for our deck, and so we need to reset the board, and that's what Heavy Fog did. Whether we attacked or defended, we could always reset the board, either by defending our own mechs by fogging it out, so it's a negative fog, or by fogging out their attack. Either way, it worked, because it protected our mechs or made their mechs useless. So that's why I have 6 of them in 97. Now in 98, like Terry, we actually had a little bit more intricate choices as far as, because the metagame had evolved and we had more understanding of what the metagame looked like.
Yeah.
And so we actually have some 2-ofs and some 1-ofs targeting certain different decks.
And we talked earlier there, guys, about kind of that, the competitive scene leading into that first world, and kind of how you guys kind of came into kind of building your own decks. but you guys, you know, went through that process and came out with two very different decks. And so I'm kind of curious, and Michael, I'll just keep you on, since I'm sure you're available and you would love to kind of hop in on this. And Michael's been kind of my mentor in the TCG, because as I've been kind of doing this and building it. But for that first tournament, we talked a little bit of kind of a broader scheme, but we didn't really, kind of get your kind of little storytelling aspect of it, of kind of, what led you to those specific decks and kind of what your experiences was with that tournament, with that world's tournaments, and kind of any kind of memories that you might have. I know we're drawing, asking a lot for 23-year-old memory to kind of recall any kind of games or moments in that tournament that kind of may have stood out for you. And certainly, your game against each other, if you guys have kind of any stories or kind of key moments that kind of swung it either way.
Go ahead, Terry.
I know we played each other in 97 in the finals. Yep. Peter can tell that story.
Yeah.
My experience was I don't remember the game well until he reminded me last week, but I remember at the end thinking, man, my deck is really lousy. I was like, this guy is a much better deck than me. And I said, I'm not going to repeat that mistake next year. So what we did is we went out and we really prepared carefully. And, we saw that Peter was the guy to beat, and we knew that he liked Fenrir-style fast decks. So we wanted to make a deck that inherently we thought would do well against those decks, and I think we did. We tried all the different decks. We had a deck of each time. I had a lot of cards. Like, I went out and bought the cards instead of, like, whatever I had lying around in 97. I traded unopened packs of Legends and Magic. I probably did not get a good deal considering what those packs might have been worth now. But, I traded a bunch of Magic cards away and bought Battletech cards. And so we had everything we needed. We built all the decks. We played it all. And we were really ready against the meta and how to play against the different decks. When do you attack? When do you have to pick off resources? What do you do?
You had a team. You guys are both using the word "we" a lot, which is really interesting to me. Did you both have like a team behind you, like a small group of people who helped you prep, like for a boxing trainer?
So for me, I worked with a guy named Shuyuk Ao. He was third place in the 97 Worlds and second place in the 98 Worlds. Yep. In 97, we played different decks because we just didn't really have enough cards. And I don't know which... neither of my decks, I think, were all that good. And then in 98, we played nearly identical decks. Our sideboards were a bit different, but otherwise, they were almost card for card the same. And we played a lot of games against each other and really played. I think to succeed at a high level in any game, you cannot do it alone. It wasn't possible back then. And I don't think it's possible now.
Yeah, no, it's not.
So Peter,
I think in 98, you came first and second with the Sandhurst Royal Military Academy deck.
Yes.
Which has generated so many arguments since then. I'd love to get into some. I have a whole question about all the arguments that have been generated.
All right. I don't know about those arguments. That sounds interesting to hear. Maybe Peter, you can go to add to the question. I have one story that I told last week. Maybe I'll tell again about my really memorable moment.
We'll get back to it.
Yes, I'll tell you the story that I told last week, which is actually, I need to thank Terry and Sui for my actual world championship win. And the reason why is that I was actually going to play Steiner. My actual love is for Steiner. My house is Steiner. I'm a Steiner player. That's what I played in Battletech, the miniature game. That's what I was going to play. And there was a pre-tournament the night before actual Worlds in 97. It was six rounds. And so, of course, I was playing my Steiner deck because we didn't know any better to actually hide our decks, for the tournament the night after. And two rounds into the tournament, my buddy Dave, and by the way, speaking of a team, yes, Royal Olympic Guards, my home crowd here, that's who I test with. There's five of us that essentially play all types of games. We're gaming nerds, and we get together on Saturdays and Sundays, and Fridays and Saturdays, and play games, all types of games. That's actually where I get all my playtesting done. But Dave comes to me in round two and goes, Peter, we can't play this deck. And I'm like, I'm like hardcore Steiner. I have a miscommunications deck that locks you out. By turn four or five, all your decks are locked down. All your mechs are locked down and you can't play the game anymore. I just keep on recurring miscommunication, locking down all your decks. You don't get to play the game. It's very unfun for you, very fun for me. And then I wreck your stockpile. One of the funnest decks I've ever played, one of the most unfun for my opponent. And Dave goes, we can't play it. And I'm like, what do you mean we can't play it? And he's like, I just faced the deck that after round four, I was staring at my cards and I was like, why am I playing this game? I'm dead. I can't do anything. And I'm like, dude, there is no such deck. What are you talking about? Because remember, there's no metagame. We can't go look on the web. We only have our own local metagame, so we only know our own decks. And he's like, yeah, I just faced a Davian deck that just smoked me. Like, I have no idea how you could ever beat that deck. And I'm like, well, the Wolf would beat it. And he's like, no, I'm not even sure Wolf can, but he might stand a better chance. But we can't play Steiner. And I'm like, no, you're full of it. We're going to play Steiner for sure. And we keep on playing the tournament. I'm undefeated going into round six. And I'm sitting across from Su Yikao, Terry's friend. He's playing the Davian deck. And sure enough, round four or five rolls around, and I'm staring at the board, and I'm dead. There's literally nothing I can do. He's swarming the board with Davian mechs, and I'm like, there's nothing I can do. And that's actually why we audibled to Wolf the Knight of Worlds in 97, which was our second deck, so we knew that we could always hunt resources. So Wolf was really my second love, not my first love. Steiner was. But we knew that there was no way that the Steiner deck could beat the Davian Swarm deck after having faced it on Friday night. So we swapped to the Wolf deck to hunt resources on Saturday and at the Worlds Tournament.
Now, do you have, and kind of recalling your game against Terry, you know, were there kind of any standout moments or, you know, any kind of cards that really kind of came through yeah. for you at the end?
Well,
or?
Yeah, that's definitely true. The card I hate the most in the card game period is Superior Navigation, because I can't stand any cards with die rolls, just like Terry was talking about the card that, you know, gives you advantages over things. Superior Navigation is my nemesis, because, you know, you get that one or a two and you run a mech into something and it just bonks his head. And at the most critical moments when that happens, you just lose games. But yet, the card was so explosive and so good that Dave and I could just simply not play the card. So we had to have it in there, because when you roll that five or a six and you get to suddenly, you know, go again and sack two resources in one turn, nothing beats it when you have Mr. Spanky on turn two and you Superior Nav and suddenly your opponent is back in the Stone Age. And so in the finals against Terry in round one, I managed to get board control fairly early. I controlled his resources and the game ends. In game two, I missed my resource on turn, I think it was three or four, and that gave him just enough time to get his mech, his pilot into his mech, and he goes off, and there's just nothing I can do. And so we go into game three, and in game three, that's when I get the dream scenario where I get the Dasher A out. And I flip it, and I have to play the Infernal Superior Navigation. And with a shaky hand, I roll the die, and I roll a five. And I destroy two of his resources. And that set him back to a point where two turns later, Terry goes to play a pilot onto my mech. And I'm like, wait. And then he's like, no, I'm conceding. And I'm like, oh, okay. I was so focused on the game, I didn't even realize that was his play because he had no other play to make.
Gotcha. So. Well, you got your revenge the next year, Terry.
So. Yeah. Well, actually, Su Yip did because he was the one who eliminated. I placed third the next year. Yeah. It was to his Sandhurst deck, but Su Yip was who beat me in the semifinals.
Definitely.
Yeah. So I have one more story to tell. It goes back to the first Majors Pro Tour I played in, I guess it was probably 96, I think it was 96, where I'm in the quarterfinals, I'm about to win, and I attack with my creatures, and then I ask my opponent, do you have any fast effects? He says no, and I go to play a card that will do enough damage and kill him, and I win the semifinals. It's game three. And the head judge comes in and says, no, you're not allowed to do that. And he makes a ruling, which was very new at the time. He says, well, once you say, do you have any fast effects, you pass off your right to play. And if your opponent says no, there's no more time for you to play. And that avoids kind of this like bizarre scenario where you each say, no, you go. And it's sort of a clear turn order, but it was relatively new. And I felt to, and I, so I'm not allowed to play my card. my opponent draws the next turn and kills me with the card, and I lose, and I'm eliminated from the tournament. And I felt that was a very unfair ruling, because it didn't have to. Usually, you don't want to have a ruling interfere with the game. It was very clear with what my intention was. I had a very clear play, and it could have let the game proceed naturally, and I would have won. I think that would have been the best ruling. So that didn't necessarily hurt me, because it means I didn't qualify for Worlds. I had to go and requalify, and then I ended up winning a Pro Tour because I had worked so hard, and it wasn't necessarily bad for me, but I remember that play and that head judge. Come BattleTech, it's the same head judge. Now, I guess he's been, instead of the Magic head judge, he's now the BattleTech head judge, and I'm in the quarterfinals, and there's a card like Kai, Champion of Solaris, that does 2 damage to all mechs in combat with Kai. So we're in a big fight, and I think Kai lets you like win initiative or something like that. There's, you know, he's got way more initiative than I do. So we do a bunch of damage. He uses Kai's ability, does 2 damage to all mechs, and I say, well, okay, that mech dies. He says, well, why? He says, Kai does 2 damage to him. He says, no, Kai only does damage to your opponents. I'm like, no, it's just all 2 damage to all mechs in combat with Kai. My mechs and your mechs, we're all in combat together. Yeah. Head judge comes, makes the ruling, says, yep, 2 damage to all mechs. And I think I win the game and the tournament because of that. I was very, very close to losing to that pilot deck. And later, the creators come back to the head judge and say, you know, that was clearly the wrong ruling. Kai doesn't hurt his own friends, right? Like... So I felt like a bit of a karmic balance to have a restoration from what I thought were 2 bad rulings down from the same judge, one that hurt me and one that helped me. So that was kind of my key moment. Otherwise, I would have been a quarterfinalist in the, maybe 5th in the tournament.
Well, they say it's the hardest lessons that are the best. So it sounds like it worked out on the Magic side of things as well.
Yeah, it was okay. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was okay.
So, Michael, what is this controversy, these arguments that are coming? You know, please share.
First of all, I want to back up and say you've just given me, Terry, something to add to the FAQ.
Okay.
I had never noticed the textual change between Kai Champion Merc Warrior version and Kai Champion Commander's Edition version. I maintain a list of all cards that had significant textual changes, okay, and that wasn't on it.
I'll add that. It needs to be on it for a specific reason.
Yeah, because the card itself was clear, I thought it does 2 damage to all mechs in combat. You know, I think the judge's ruling in that sense was correct. That's what the card said, but it was not what the creators intended.
Yeah, it actually reads that way. It clearly is not. Kai doesn't hurt his own mechs.
Well, it depends on the definition of engaged in battle with.
I mean, that's obviously where even the head judge got it wrong, right? I mean, the wording is piss poor. I mean, it clearly should state that it just hurts opponents' mechs, right?
Let's dive in. I got a couple other questions from the community. I want to make sure that...
Sure, let's do it.
It's been a pleasure to meet you guys. I'll drop off.
Awesome. All right. Thank you, Michael.
Great meeting you. Bye-bye. Thank you for what you're doing for the community.
I'd love to see you post on the Facebook group. Join us.
Connect then. Yeah. All right. So next one up was another member of the community and one of the patrons of this channel and who was kind of in that my first kind of discussion there with Michael talking about the history game. But Chester Hendricks has been kind of really involved in kind of that evolution that Michael was involved in with the creating an expansive card set and kind of almost doubling the cards available to those that are playing online. But Chester was really interested in kind of that very unique prize that you got, Peter, after that first world championship of getting to design your own card. And so, and Chester was really interested in kind of the process that you went through and kind of getting that card made and the parameters and the process for the art and how long it took, basically kind of just kind of tell us about that kind of that unique prize. And
so sadly, once again, as we said last week, I actually didn't get to design the card because I would have never designed that crappy a card. Now that said, it was cool to have the card.
Yeah.
I mean, that was fun. But yeah, no, MechWarrior Peter, as awesome as the artwork is and as awesome as the card is, I had no say in any of it.
Hmm. And that kind of...
I would have made a Dasher-style attack mech, not a MechWarrior, because I was never into playing MechWarriors. That was Terry's thing. That's actually what Terry should have had as a card.
Yeah. I didn't get my card. It was promised. Yeah. It was one of the prizes, but it didn't happen. If someone is reprinting or creating a new set and they want to create
card, they should make the Terry card.
Yeah, come talk to me. I'll help you make a card, and we'll do something cool. I'll play test it.
And it should be and that should be a pilot.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, Terry, I got. Yeah. I was telling you, I got that the template for the cards, which looks spot on. It looks beautiful. So let's collaborate, and you can tell me that card, and I'll print it up, and I'll share it with that group, and anyone can play it. That'll be awesome.
Awesome.
And Peter, you can do that too. Like, so let's say, what's the card that you would have designed, and let's make the true, could have been, should have been, Peter and Terry world champion cards, and I'll make those customs and share them with the group. So that
okay, that would be awesome.
And maybe we could think of a card that would change some of the meta. Like, rather than something that would fit with my deck, maybe I'll think about something that would make large mechs more playable.
That would be
a way to build infrastructure, bootstrap it.
You're speaking sweet nothings to me, Taylor. Because for me, one of my big things and the things I've been doing with the own cards I've been customizing, completely revamping the costing and definitely I want to get Peter, to give some insights into what his card would be, but then I just want to
destroy resources, man.
Okay.
So that's what Wolf does best.
We'll figure out a good card that's not broken, but it's good, and that Peter knows that we're still playing. He put it in every one of his decks, and
definitely. Listen, I tried. I tried so hard to put Mechwar and Peter. He sucks so bad. My play group was laughing at me every time they had him. I put him in my deck. They're like, again, Peter, again, really?
Peter is like the kind of the guy who's inherited his family's mech and really has no business being in a mech.
That card is terrible. I just looked it up. It is awful. Yeah,
it's miserable.
It's like, how often is your fast? Yeah. No, it's just awful.
Awesome. It caught my mullet, though. That was pretty cool.
Awesome.
Yeah,
there we go.
It's too bad if it could work on any mech. At least you could have like a big mech.
Yeah.
Damage
that it might be worth. Yeah.
It just like.
No, it's just useless.
Yeah. Well, Peter, your mullet is in true homage to original.
It's a nice picture, but
it's like you pick up those original BattleTech source books, and it is mullet central. So that's a good.
Yeah.
It would fit perfectly into the BattleTech universe.
Yes, Hadley, you can't quite see it. I just donated 18 inches, so okay. I do
18. Oh my goodness!
That's why it's only shoulder length right now. About every 2 years, I donate 18 inches.
Oh my goodness. So let's get into kind of my fan question, which is, the costing. How would you say if I can throw it, I can make all my custom cards, how would you fix the costing on the big mix? Is it just a matter of kind of bringing the cost down and then piggybacking onto that? As a new player, I still don't understand in terms of the card construction of like the considerations for adding the resource buyouts. Even to the point where I'm like, well, maybe if I have this and I put the base cost a little low, but I put like an undesirable buyout, like a logistics or something that'll kind of possibly raise the cost. But anyway, I want to kind of throw it to you guys. If you were just going to recost those big mechs, what would the adjustment be? What would the thresholds be for bringing them down so that they're playable, viable, but not broken?
Who do you want? Pick a person.
Terry, let's go.
Look, so the way I like to look at the world is see what did other games do to make that work, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how did Magic let you fight with big dragons or Hearthstone let you cast 10 cost creatures? And, Hearthstone has a taunt idea, right? Is where you go and you have to attack that mech first, right? Mm-hmm. That's a way that you can, stall out the game that way. You have to be very careful with that ability. Mm-hmm. I think you just make them cost less. Like, when you look at what, like, a 13 cost mech or something like that. Like, they're awful. Like, if I look at here's like an example, a Mad Cat C I have up on screen. It costs 11. It's a 2 armor, 9 hit point. It does 5 damage. It's got 1 missile. It has overheat 2 plus 2 attack. Like, that mech's just not really that good. And for 11, like, you spend all that mana, what do you get from that? It's very little. So that thing should cost like 7, right? The other thing you can do is that you can play cards that reduce the cost of your more expensive mechs by 1, right? Or your next mech cost less, right? So it's kind of a construction. Maybe it's a resource card that lets you put 2 or 3 resource counters on a large mech, kind of like Urza's Mines in Magic. is another way of doing that. The battle cry mechanic, where you can restore some cards to buy you some time to build a deck, or having a large mech automatically start guarding your stockpile, something like that, right?
Okay.
Yeah. Build it, or you know, or a mech that is upgradable, so you spend 5 mana on it, and anytime you want to, you flip it over or something, or you flip it the other way, and now it's a bigger mech, and you spend 6 more resources on it. Right. So you have like the mini version and then the expanded armed version or something like that. So it lets you upgrade it, you know, and that way you could try to get to the point where you're playing a bit of a longer game, and you know, the time when you have tons of mana on turn 9 or 10, you can actually do something.
Gotcha. Peter, what would be your approach? Similar or slightly different?
Oh yeah, I think Terry hit the nail on the head. I mean, the fact is that there's already been successful ways of doing it in other games.
Yeah.
And I mean, like a recovery mechanic or an acceleration mechanic, I think one or the other is probably what you need to do. Gotcha. The problem with the recovery mechanic is that if you get it too late, you're just dead. So right. I actually think that it probably has to be an acceleration mechanic, because the, you know, mechs are too overcosted as they are currently. So yeah. Unless you're actually going to go into the game already and then, fix their costs, I'm pretty sure that you have to accelerate somehow.
And one thing I'd noticed too, and just in terms of some of the values on those big mechs, you know, they were just kind of ramping up values. I mean, there were big mechs with 11 attacks and stuff like that. And if you go to the tabletop, you know, even that big mech that they had cost 11 attack, and you compare it to another heavy mech that might be a three or four attack, that mech in tabletop doesn't bring almost three times the attack value. And so when I was kind of building my own, like I found that it really maxed out if I was kind of, you know, looking at the weapons and how much damage they contribute without overheating, that it really maxed out around 6. And the most I found was 7, and the weapons on that particular mech were all short range. And so I put a little custom text in there saying that it couldn't target any mech that was faster than it in order to justify that. But yeah, it maxed out at 6. And then it, you know, the extra attack from the extra weapons came through overheat and alpha strike. And that was also a way that I felt, and it helped me justify bringing the cost down into a range that was appropriate. But yeah, I was, you know, maybe I'll toss some cards out to you guys so you can look and you know, you can use your expertise to see if it's crazy or not.
I can't remember. Is the Daishi A in game?
It is in game, and it is not playable. So the closest one to playable was the Daishi B. And actually the Daishi Prime is one of the ones that I cast. Let's throw it up. Let's have a little fun. We'll do a little screen share.
Because the Daishi A is in the miniature game is probably the heat tightest. And the clan mech that puts out the most power.
Yeah.
It's running so, the pulse lasers that hit, that have, they have positives to hit, and the clan pulse lasers technology is essentially heat tight.
Yeah. So in the card game, that's a 17 cost mech with a 12. Yeah.
I just 12, pulled it up on screen.
Attack. Yeah. And I'll throw it up here for people to look
like,
at.
I don't know how you get 17 so resource into it. Like, no, what do you
17
do?
17 cost?
Yeah. That's nuts. Let me try.
I think 12, the 12 attack?
Yeah. The highest is Prometheus. I think that has a 20 cost.
Yeah. It has a 20 cost. It's insane.
Wow.
Here, let me do it. We'll do it.
Prometheus is a named Daishi, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's the only one. It's unique.
Yeah, I was going to say.
No, there's a Widowmaker.
Oh, yeah, I see the Widowmaker here. That's a 411 plus 12.
Which is Natasha Kerensky's one, right?
Right. Yeah.
That's Natasha Kerensky's mech.
It's unique, yeah.
Yeah.
And Gustav, you know, and Mark had a deck where they basically used Omninet Pods cache to get out. They had a combo to pop out the cheapest Daishi early, I think like turn 3 or something, and then they used the Omnimet podcast to swap it with the Widowmaker, and then they could start attacking with the Widowmaker. So that was the only known way to kind of actually put those cards in play.
What card was that? I'm going to look up which card you're talking about.
So he had Omnimet podcast, which basically allows you to pay for any version of a mech and then swap it for another version.
Okay.
Discarding cards.
Yeah, so it cheats it into play.
Yeah. Exactly. And that was the only way. And so he had 6 Daishis, the cheapest one, and then he kind of swapped it in for the hardest hitting one. But yeah, let me do this. I'll take advantage of having you guys, and I'll do my own little geek out. So let me do a screen share of the one that I made, and you guys can give me your input. There's a...
Oh, I see. Oh, that's a dasher. Never mind, not dashy. Okay.
Yeah, now there's big difference between those two.
Yeah, I know. I can see that now.
one is a small, fast mech, and the other one is a heavy 100-ton mech.
Yeah. All right, so do you guys see this one now?
Yeah, the dire wolf.
So there's two numbers that are wrong, right? So on the, I can't figure out how to do double digits, but I had it costed at 11, and the structure is 11, but I haven't figured out how to do a double digit on either of those bubbles yet. But otherwise, it's where I came up with. So yeah, it's like it maxes out at 6. I mean, obviously, there's lots of other damage if you're doing other things, but if that was 11 cost with 11 structure, what do you guys think? You know, give me your opinion on
it. So overheats for free.
Yeah, overheats for free. If it's not taking damage from other places.
Well, no, yeah, obviously, yeah.
Yeah, you need war funds. Don't nerf war funds if you're gonna play.
Yeah, this mech is not playable without war funds.
Yep.
You're not gonna see the resources to get this up.
Well, and that was my main question is that, all right, so it's definitely 11 structure, and basically everything in the stat box is pulling from in-game stats, and so it's comparing it to other games. It's what I consider the most appropriate for what the weapon loadout. But that my question is, you know, ignoring all of those that base cost and buyouts, what would you guys set the base cost and buyout to make this mech viable without broken?
What does long range 4 do again?
Long range is damage that you can assign to the target.
Oh, right. Okay,
if you're blocked. And usually in the game it's maxed out at 2, but I ignore that rule in mine, and I just considered any damage that came from a weapon with a range greater than 21 could contribute long range, and with the 4 large lasers.
Yes, so your question
can bleed through 4 no matter what.
Right. So the question, if you had 4 armor and 11 structure instead of 8 and still did 6 damage, what would be a good cost for that mech?
Yes, that's my question.
So 4, 11, 6.
411.6. Yep.
That's pretty powerful. Because it's a missile, it has a good overheat.
Yep. Yeah, it's got a free overheat essentially. So once again, obviously, if you take damage, you take damage.
Yeah, but no, you. I mean, but when you attack, you can do 10.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's free overheat.
It's been a while since I played the game. I think if you could set that at around 10, you might be playable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was gonna say I saw an 11 in my mind when I saw this thing.
11 with no buyouts, or with what buyouts would you guys use on that?
I would scale back the buyouts to lower than the 3s, probably 2s, maybe.
Yeah, and again, those are just fillers that I just happen to plug that in. That's what happens to be
twos,
on this template.
I would do 2s and drop the L.
2s and drop the L, okay.
Yeah, do APM 2s and 11 cost.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that seems reasonable.
It's probably still too high, sadly enough, but I mean...
Yeah, I mean, the other thing you do is you could create the formula and make a change so that every point gets you more, gets you an increasing amount,
yep.
Right? So every extra cost you spend, instead of getting you like 3/4 of an arm or whatever, you increase that by 50% and see where you end up with in terms of costing, if that's reasonable.
Yeah,
for sure.
And what, Peter, what makes you choose P over L? Like, what are your considerations there?
Specifically, since you wanted it to be playable, is actually what because L is just not that playable in game in my mind.
Gotcha. And so then, so you were saying 11 with AMP?
Yep, AMP 2.
All right. I would drop some of that, you know, maybe just put A and M.
Sure.
You know, that way, otherwise,
yeah, I could go with that.
It's too hard to build a deck around it. Like, you know, you don't want to be frustrated that where you can't cast that thing.
And is it viable to kind of to maybe artificially lower the base cost by adding those undesirable buyouts? So if you were going to say 11 with AM, and just maybe say like you know a 1L or 1P and make it 9 instead, you know, and then most people aren't going to want to have LRP, but if they are doing LRP, they could. Is that a viable way to do things?
I don't think adding the resource cost is worth it.
Yeah,
because I think it makes it less playable.
Interesting. Okay.
I think it's just less fun. I think it's less fun. Well, I always hated like those costs and those things. Like I thought, you know, I get why, you know, this is really a very similar system to Magic in many ways, right? These are multicolor mechs, right? Designed by the same guy.
Yeah, it's a 4-color mech.
Yeah. I'd rather minimize that.
Cool. Yep.
So like 11 with 3A, 3M.
Yeah.
Cool.
Or two, like Terry said. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thanks for humoring me, guys. That was fun. That was like my little fan thing. Let's see, grab my questions back.
So we have a couple more from the community. Oh, they were asking kind of, you know, what has been your exposure into the game, you know, since kind of dropping off? Have you guys kind of played it all, you know, since then? Any kind of, you know, pickup games or tournaments or casual?
I played exactly once since the 98 Worlds, okay. And that was at Gen Con maybe a decade ago. Someone had a box, which I have lots of Battletech cards and sealed, you know, uncut sheets. I got all kinds of crazy swag if people want something or they're interested. I don't know what to do with it. Sitting in my parents' house for 20 years, but I've got it. I played about 10 years ago at Gen Con. There was like a 2-round tournament or something. It was fun. Yeah, we had a good
time. Awesome.
Yeah, I had a good time.
Yeah, maybe I can connect with you. You know, when I get a little funds, I can send maybe pick up a box of Arsenal or something from you because
I could take a look what I have. Awesome. What I really want to find a home for is my uncut cards.
Yeah,
I don't know what to do with them.
On the Facebook page, BattleTech CCG trade and sell page. You know, so you could obviously go eBay, go that route. But if you want to kind of hit those fans at BattleTech trade and sell, there's a trade and sell general for BattleTech, and there's one for the CCG. And I'm sure the community would love to kind of have that posted.
I want them to be used. Like, I actually don't really care. But like, I'm fortunate in my life to not be that cost sensitive, right? Yeah, I've had a long, solid career. But, awesome. You know, I want people to be using that stuff, right? Like, if it goes up on your wall, I'm happy. I feel like it's done something with it. If you throw it away, forget it.
I'm sure we could find a home. There's a lot of
people. Yeah, that would be interesting. I'm wondering what to do with them. And I don't see a way to use it in my house.
Awesome. Well, we'll connect. We'll find a good
home. Okay, we can connect after. Yeah.
Find it a good home for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Peter, any cool swag that you guys got other than that card sheet that Terry mentioned?
I mean, I have the Zeus painting, I guess. That's the one thing that I got from the first Worlds.
Yeah.
So that was kind of cool. So I got
that. Yeah. I wanted that painting because I actually played the Zeus. I had a lot to play for, but then I was like, I also have some of the original art, but not the one I really wanted.
I got the Zeus in Terry's deck. Yeah.
Well, Peter was trying to play the Zeus, but he kind of his intelligence agents, you know, told him to not do that.
Yeah, intelligence agents told me no Zeus.
No Zeus.
Awesome. Go with the clan.
Peter, how about you? Have you played since kind of the glory days?
You know, I only played one game as well, and that was at DecipherCon in 2002 against Gustav, actually, and he reminded me exactly why I quit the game.
Oh no!
He brought out the busted version of the Sandhurst deck and goes, "Hey, you might play in your '97 World Championship deck against this one," and I'm like, being the accommodating World Champion, I'm like, "Sure, I'll play it," and of course he locked me up in 3 turns and just beat the snot out of me, and I'm like, "Hey, yeah, that's the deck that made me quit the game."
Oh no! Well, that's power creep for you, right? You know, if you took a Magic deck from 1997, then you're probably not gonna hold up very well.
Yeah, no, it's not gonna hold up too well. It is not.
Simply. No, it was all in good fun.
Yeah, yeah.
No, sadly does highlight, however, how badly they treated the creep at the end. Yeah, those free deploy things are no good.
Well, if you guys ever get the itch, you know, they've done a good job setting it up on Lackey and Tabletop Simulator. So you might, you know, kind of hop in or, you know, come in as a guest.
Check out the Facebook page. Awesome. So you can play live or play online.
Yeah, there's 2 ways. The Lackey is the way that most people kind of steer people. It's a very rudimentary look to it, but it's the most functional. And then you can also play on Tabletop Simulator, which looks a lot better, but it's a lot more clunky to build the decks particularly. But yeah, if you go into the announcement section for you and for everyone listening of the Facebook, the BattleTech CCG Facebook page, and you can just hop in and ask a question there. I'm sure, you know, the guys would love to kind of guide you through. Michael's a great job kind of, you know, talking through, but even I, in my rudimentary skill, was able to install Lackey, you know, as a non-computer guy in general. You know, if you guys get on, you know, let me know and maybe we can set up kind of like a celebrity homage tournament, you know, and I can record that and we can put it on the channel. People would love that, I'm sure. kind of looking back, do you guys remember any kind of decks from other players that really kind of stood out as kind of really creative, really innovative, that you really enjoyed or really feared kind of, you know, playing back in the day?
Yeah, I mean, definitely Zvi Mozovic's Mechlist deck was the one that stands out to me. I mean, that was...
And that was with what, Strategic Bombardment, and then just a ton of resources.
Okay. Yeah, correct. He built up. It was Mechlist. He built up this massive bombardment, and just nuked you out of the sky. I played him in the quarterfinals in 98, and I beat him in game one. I managed to get the bombardment under control. In game two, the bombardment slipped out from my. He made me attack his resources, and the bombardment went out of control, and he nuked me. And in game three. There was one turn where I managed to get the bombardment down just enough to buy myself enough time to build up a resource sacking team. But then he managed to draw into his diversion, the diversion cards. I can't remember what they're called now. But he managed to start diverting me, and I'm like, oh no, this is slipping out of control. And he got to a point where literally the bombardment was big enough to finish me off if he could draw it. And so, but I have a sacking team that's big enough to just kill all of his resources in one go. Yeah. So we're literally down to like, he's going to draw his two cards and I either kill him and sack his resources and the game ends, or he draws the bomb off the top of the deck the resource to finish off, because he needed a resource to tap to finish me off. And we're both like, okay, flip him. And he flips the two cards, and lucky for me, it's not the resource he needed. Mm-hmm. So that's how I managed to finish him off. Yeah. But man, that was a memorable game, because it came down to literally those two cards flipped off the top of the deck.
Awesome.
And that was what put me up against Tsuya Kao in the semis that I then ultimately ended up losing in Sanders' deck. And that was once again another game that went to three games that came down to one last attack where I needed a resource and I didn't draw it.
Awesome. Terry, any decks that really stood out to you or were memorable that weren't your own back in the day?
Peter described. I thought that was a cool deck, and he did a good job on it.
Awesome. Now, for you guys, and I know Terry, you dropped off, almost immediately after winning that in 1998. But Peter, you stuck on for a little bit. Where for either of you, were there decks that you really enjoyed playing or that you played a lot, other than kind of the ones that you were known for? That just kind of maybe didn't make it into those tournament lists that have survived through the years that we can all see. Other than that Steiner deck, Peter, for the other games that you like to, other decks that you really like to play in casual games, when you weren't playing the Boomer.
I played that Miscommunication deck so much. I loved to, it was literally a lockdown deck.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember Miscommunications, but it puts three counters on a mech.
Yeah.
And they come off one by one, and your mech doesn't untap, right? And so I'd recurse the card.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd literally lock down your whole entire board.
Yeah, and I remember when I was trying to connect with you, and it was Gustav that eventually connected us, Peter, but I had found a couple links for you playing Magic, and you were playing a blue control. So I feel like that's kind of in your blood there.
It is. That's where it came from. That was literally the first deck that I was gravitating to. Was I saw Miscommunication, and I'm like, man, if I can recurse this somehow, I can lock down their board. Definitely. And so I found a way to do that. And that was my other deck. I mean, obviously resource controlling does the same, essentially the same thing. You just control their resources instead of their mechs. So
gotcha.
Either way, you lock them down and they don't get to have fun.
Yeah. Terry, were there other decks that you kind of, you enjoyed playing with Suyik, that led to kind of what you guys ultimately settled on?
You know, I always wanted to play decks with big mechs, which could not make it work. I could not find any way to play those cards successfully. Like, there are styles in Magic where you control early and then you bring out a Sarah Angel and just keep attacking with this 4/4 flyer that doesn't attack. That's your whole strategy. It's a very old school style. And I thought we could do that with big mechs where, you bring out a big mech and you just keep chump blocking with these little mechs and a kill one mech per turn kind of thing. Then finally I hit your stockpile for 15, that kind of attack. We could not make that work. The other thing I did like though is playing with a bunch of random cards where like some sort of draft or sealed deck. I thought that was always really fun, especially when you're pretty tight on cards, because it makes you play a different set of cards other than the most optimal ones. And I always thought that was way more enjoyable and different rather than a deck that basically plays kind of the same way. And, when I was playing my World Champion deck, I could play that on automatic pilot, really.
Awesome.
And that wasn't, you know, I'd already played it. It wasn't as much fun.
And I know some of the guys with that online community, they've kind of, they're trying to work up, you know, this cube system for drafting so that they can essentially kind of draft online. So maybe, you know, kind of the more people talk about it and kind of lens for that, maybe it'll get enough interest that people can kind of complete that idea and kind of make it happen.
Because it gets around all of the card problems that you're describing, right? Depending on how you do it, it still doesn't make Big Macs are much more playable in a draft.
Gotcha.
Right. When you don't have all those optimized other cards and, you know, the 4, 5, 6, 7 cost max I found were a sweet spot in draft kind of thing, if I recall. So, you know, it may be a reasonable compromise.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, that takes care of my questions. This has been a fun conversation, guys, even though, you know, a lot of it was second, you know, I thought it was just as fun having it the second time. I really appreciate you guys taking twice the time to sit down, because I know the community would love it. And I know we talked about this last time, but, you know, if there were anybody watching and they have some questions of their own, you know, maybe that we didn't cover here, if they can kind of throw them down in the comments down below, and I can kind of show you guys the link for the video, of course, once it gets posted. Maybe we can you can pop in to the video, you know, a couple times over that first month, and if you see any questions that people want to kind of present to you guys, maybe kind of do a little your own little Q&A. That would be really awesome. I'm sure that the
fans. Be happy to.
Yeah, sure, no problem.
Yeah, and final shout outs, you know, for Renegade HPG, you know, make sure you're subscribing to the channel, and more importantly, kind of sharing it and getting out to the community. You know, I think just kind of the more people kind of, you know, are seeing that there are still ways to kind of engage with the TCG, that they can play online. And there's also ways, if you talk to that Facebook group, that you can get your card set without spending lots of money on eBay. So you know, there's my little kind of wink and hint. Go to that Facebook page. And definitely, you know, for everyone out there, you know, if you can support this channel, help me kind of, you know, cover the cost and put more content out there. Check out Renegade HPG on Patreon. And with that, I'll give my final heartfelt thanks to you guys for having this conversation. It's been a ton of fun. And I'll circle back with you, you know, Terry, and we'll find a way to get some of those cool memorabilia out to the community, to people who will love it and cherish it. And I definitely, if we can get that kind of retrospective, a rematch, a digital rematch of you guys, maybe on a Lackey or one of those other, that'd be awesome. That can be a future episode, but that's it. So this is Travis signing off for Renegade HPG. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.